The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Well, 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 Mr. Feldman, we have a CBA agreed to very late, just before the deadline on Friday night. Kind of interesting that this is when they chose, right before the playoffs, all this interesting stuff in the season. Would have been nice if this happened, you know, December 15th when nothing was going on. But hey, that's fine. We're going to get to it here. So I wanted to ask you, and first off, I want to say this. Just congratulations to everyone who worked on that. I know you and I both talked to people who were working on this. It was clearly a marathon session on that last day. And I think as much as people have been wanting to like crap on Adam Silver lately, and I've said this recently on the pod, but now that it's confirmed, it's worth reiterating. Let's not take it for granted that we have labor peace. There were two lockouts in three CBAs before Adam Silver took over. And yeah, like the money's been growing and everyone says, oh, there's too much. Nobody wants to kill the golden goose at this point. But, you know, all these other sports have growing TV money as well. And yet they had all this animosity over their CBAs. And, you know, you had like the NFL players like barely approving theirs and it like not being recommended. And then all this shit about COVID and like so and the adjustments there with both baseball and football. So this is impressive to me. It's a feather in the cap to everyone involved. I just congratulate everyone for getting a deal done. That's why they negotiate, to get a deal done. Maybe we'll start here. Well, no, we'll do this at the end. First thing I want to ask you, what do you think is the most significant thing that is going to be changed?
We're going to talk about this and you might talk me out of this, but my gut answer is a weird one. I think this is definitely the most underrated part. I'm going to just say it off the bat as most significant. Licensing revenue is now going to be considered part of basketball related income. It was estimated to be about $160 million next year. In the past, that went straight to the owners. Now, I think there are two fundamental issues in the CBA at this point, because they're not changing the split other than this between owners and players. It's that basic 49-51% split, basically 50-50. We can just call it 50-50. For simplicity, that's determined by formula. That was locked in. That wasn't changing. Everybody agreed to keep that as is. And so after that, it's really, so a lot of this is about how owners are going to split up their half amongst themselves and how players are going to split their half among themselves. And then the other goal for both sides is to grow the pie, to create a system that people, that fans are going to be attracted to, that's going to create an entertaining product that fans want to watch. So the pie is even bigger. So those are the two things. Other than this, this is new money for the players. $160 million. If you look at it, I mean, this is just real rough, but if you take half of that to the players, that's $80 million. If you look at a full roster for everybody in the league, that's $150,000 per player. Like, that's a big deal. That's new money. That's the one thing I'm looking at where it's not about how we're going to split the money among the players or how we're going to split the money among the owners. It's new money for the players.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And particularly given the trend in basically all sports, and particularly this one of BRI getting chopped off from 57% down to that basically 50% in the 2011 CBA. And there basically has been no discussion of increasing the revenue. And then also, I mean, we still don't really know anything about this, but this idea that the players can actually invest in the franchises, like, and Hoopshype had a great graphic comparing franchise values growth over time to the growth in player salaries, and the growth in franchise values has quite outpaced that. So giving players a chance to invest in this through this private equity firm, I think that's a very interesting deal as well. I have no idea how it's going to work in terms of, like, do you get to keep it if you're not in the league anymore, or what happens if the team gets sold or whatever. Like, that's all fascinating, I think, though. But congratulations to the players again for getting that to happen. You think it's all window dressing or what?
I mean, the details will matter on that, right? Yeah. At some point, NBA franchise values are going to peak. I don't know if we've hit that moment. It's been predicted at different times.
Growth in them is going to peak. You think they will actually begin to decline in absolute terms?
I mean, if you look at what's going on with cable television, I have some questions long term. Obviously, his next cable TV deal is going to be very lucrative to the league. But as the system changes, maybe there's a certain point where local governments wake up and stop handing NBA owners money for arenas. And that cuts into the value of teams. Things can change. It's very it's an investment, right? Players are now allowed to make an investment. And you might invest in an NBA team and see that investment not pay off. Or maybe it doesn't even not pay off. Maybe it doesn't pay off as well as other investments that you could have made. It looks like this great investment opportunity at the moment. I'm not as convinced as it is. Like, how does it work? What if no owners want to sell their shares right now? Or, like, when an owner sells, do you get a chance to buy shares? At what price do you get to buy it? Of what teams? There's a lot of questions about the details why I'm not certain this is necessarily going to be a meaningfully good thing for players.
We should probably save that until we find out a little bit more. But still, even to get some lip service and some window dressing on that, like, that does open a Pandora's box a little bit. This is the first of its kind, and you don't see this a lot in most industries, and particularly not one where values have exploded the way they have here. And so we could discuss whether we think franchise values will continue going up another time. But yeah, I agree that BRI to get more into the pot for the players, that is very surprising to me. I would say, yeah, that's particularly because we hadn't heard anything about that. Mm-hmm. That is surprising to me that got added in. And I think also that's something where now players have more incentive to help with the promotion of licensing and stuff like that too. So, all right, that might be the most surprising. I mean, I think it's probably significant to the parties themselves. What would you say for us as fans, analysts, consumers of the game, people, you know, salary cap analysts, what do you think is most significant in terms of, like, what will be the biggest change?
I think it's the second apron, which is far closer to a hard cap than I ever thought the players would go for. It's a fascinating system. With all of these, there are questions about exactly what it looks like, where the details we're getting are somewhat vague, right? Some of these specific details are going to matter, but man, it sounds like the second apron might be a radical shakeup.
So the second apron, essentially what it is, and I like it much better than the hard cap. I also like it much better than the just increasing the tax to just an unbelievably punitive level. I think that they had success in limiting spending and limiting what the best teams could do. I think that in some ways, the first apron and its limitations, not acquiring players and sign and trade, smaller mid-level exception, etc. I think that, to me, had greater success in limiting the dominance of high-spending teams than just having a higher tax did, by far. Like, not being able to get a player in a sign and trade if you're over a certain amount, that's huge. That's because that was basically, like, you know, especially with how much more sign and trades have become prevalent now, like, if a really good player could go to a team that was already really good in free agency, even if it's by a sign trade, even if that team didn't have cap space and he was going to leave for nothing, and it's like, well, here, take what this team with cap space can give you, like, that was massive. That taking that away was massive. You know, the last sign and trade that we saw for a team that was, like, over the tax was Steve Nash, and that was pretty much it to the Lakers. So I think that if the goal is to not allow higher spending teams to dominate and to just win just because you're willing to write a bigger check and you have more revenue, like, I don't like that. I don't like that necessarily. What bothered me was when there was a feeling with the just straight up hard cap, that you're going to, you essentially would lose bird rights on players. You couldn't just re-sign your own players anymore. Like, that really would have bothered me. And in fact, the reporting from Woj on his podcast, which I recommend everyone listen to, was that, yeah, the reason that hard cap fell out of favor was that teams, like he mentioned Cleveland, for example, that had, even if there are small markets that wanted to keep their team together, that were willing to spend, had homegrown talent, wouldn't be able to do so if there was a hard cap. Now they can do that. But you basically now, what it is I think it's what it's going to be is like $17 million.
17
over the tax is yep. where it's going to start. I assume that'll increase with the bans, which we'll talk about in a second too. But essentially what it's going to be is now you don't get a mid-level exception at all, not even the taxpayer mid-level. And you also cannot add salary in trades. You got to either reduce salary or you can only take back 100% of what you're sending out. So you're basically, the only way you can add salary is the minimum rookie scale exception. There's going to be a second round exception now too. So it's basically like you can't make moves where all you're bringing to the table in terms of the move is we're willing to spend more. You have to have brought something else there, such as, oh, we drafted this guy and developed him and now we're going to pay him, you know, something like that. So I think that's okay. I don't know what your opinion is on that, but I think that that's, if especially if they're going to have more of a curb for these type of teams, I think they did it the best way that they could, if you accept the premise that some sort of a limitation has to be put on.
I do accept that premise, but just real quick to add, it's even more restrictive than you said. You gave the biggest restrictions, but there's more. You can't send out cash in a trade. You can't trade first round picks 7 years away. It's not clear, you send six away, five away.
Yeah.
Well, it could be five. It's not clear where that line is. You can't sign bought out players.
Well, yeah, I think you can only trade six years out instead of seven.
Okay, I haven't seen
that. That's how I interpreted that, at least. Again, you know, we'll update this if we find out more. No, none of us, we've got a bunch of tweets. That's our, and like a conversation here and there that I've had. That's basically our understanding of this at this point.
You can't sign a player in the buyout market, and how that's going to be defined.
I didn't see that one.
That's from Woj. I don't know. Mark what time we are into this podcast. It took longer than I thought, but I'm going to say it for the first time. Unintended consequences. Okay. So if you're over the second apron, it's first round picks, it's second round picks, it's minimum salaries to add salary. And the other thing you can do is re-sign your own players. So are the Clippers, and there's also been some reporting that a lot of these changes are kind of going to be eased in. And I don't know what that looks like. There's so many different ways they could do that, but it's not going to be in year one of the CBA necessarily that this is a hard limit and this is exactly how it works. But a team like the Clippers that I think are committed to spending big, I think Steve Ballmer is willing to spend big and create whatever advantage he can get out of that. Well, what if the Clippers just say, all right, we're going to use this time to get way, way above this apron, get our spending up, because once our spending is up, we could re-sign, you know, our 15th man for $15 million, and now we could trade him for somebody making less, right? All those players making less than $15 million, now they are available to us. Otherwise, they wouldn't be. So these teams could have a goal of getting way above the apron, because you can't get up there. Like, once you're not there, it's going to be way harder to get up there, but there's still an ability to stay up there. And so I think you're going to create some weird spending incentives. And I'm going to give one big caveat. There's so many things we don't know about how this works. There could be something that changes this, but I'm not seeing any reason that a team couldn't take that approach. And so you might end up with the Clippers having an even larger spending advantage over the rest of the league.
Yeah, I mean, you could see, and again, like, I'm sure that there are many ways that this is going to work that the framers will have thought about. They're probably even, some of the stuff they probably even haven't fully negotiated yet. They're probably still talking a lot of it through. You know, this hasn't even been, there's no fully written document for everyone to ratify yet. I mean, I have no doubts that the deal is done, but it's still, you know, working groups have to go through it and all that. But yeah, you could think of something along the lines of, okay, here, how about this? Like, we're going to re-sign this guy that's not really any good, that we don't want anymore, with bird rights, just because we have him. Let's sign him to a 3-year deal for $15 million a year, totally non-guaranteed. And then
guarantee whatever we need
through the season. Oh, hey, we want to acquire a guy who makes $8 million. Okay, we'll guarantee $8 million of your salary. We'll trade you to this other team. The other team can cut you immediately. And we just added $8 million in salary, right? Like, you could definitely see some shenanigans like that, and perhaps they'll figure out a way to rule out those sorts of things. But then you'll also have this, you know, them be like, if you think the bird rights trap is bad now,
yep,
what if you, like, you can't even make trades, you can't even you can't even use the mid-level to replace a guy? And yeah, so not only is it just having the player, but it's also keeping your salary up. But I mean, I'm sure some of these are like, well, hey, like, I mean, that might be unintended consequences, but it still is limiting. Yeah, there might be like some ways around it. Hey, if the Clippers, if their answer to this is like, we need to re-sign, Marcus Morris to $25 million a year, and that's how they're going to get around it. They really want to spend their money that way. And also, hey, well, the luxury tax will now get distributed to us. It still is making it pretty cost prohibitive to do that. I think that's, I don't mind that too much. I still think we'll see how exactly what the loopholes are. But, so yeah, I mean, there may be some unintended consequences. I don't want to go too far on that until we know exactly how a lot of these are going to work. There is one, obviously, that has a hilarious unintended consequences that we'll get to, but I really think is dumb. But
I'm glad you brought up the bird rights trap aspect of this. I've been workshopping, like, because if you're this team that's over the second apron, it's more than just the bird rights trap, as you mentioned. I've been workshopping, how about bird rights, oh crap, because you're in deep shit. Like, it is more than the typical bird rights trap for a good player, let alone where you're talking about of like signing a gimmick player for trade purposes. But somebody you actually want on your team, you're screwed.
Yeah. And so this is going to make, I think also, frankly, this is kind of interesting if we think about the consequences. And once again, I mean, we could do an entire podcast on each one of these rules of the. So we're going to try to make this more of an overview. I'm sure we'll get into more of it. We'll do a whole like another 2-hour episode once the CBA comes out, like right on the day that all 8 game ones have been completed, you know, like about that. But I think where was I now? I started getting mad that this is happening at this time of year. What was I talking about?
Well, we're talking about the second apron and just how extreme.
I remember what I was going to say. Oh, it is that time again. Wedding season. Indochino's custom suits will have you walking into a wedding looking like $1 million, feeling like $1 million, because their suits are custom made to fit you perfectly. You can get a tailored fit from the comfort of your home. You can set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website, choose customizations without even leaving the house. Indochino was the official outfitter of my wedding. I got a tux from them. All my groomsmen got custom fitted sport jackets, and I'd like to think we all look great. Order your custom suit now. Be ready for wedding season, whether it's at home or in person at a showroom New Year, which I actually recommend. That's what I did. An Indochino style guy can walk you through all of the amazing customizations that they have. The lapels, the lining, single-breasted, double-breasted. You can feel the fabrics in person. That's definitely the best way to do it, in my opinion. But you can also do it from home as well. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com. Use that familiar cap space code to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com. Indochino. Indochino.com. Don't forget that cap space code to let them know you came from us. Renters, you ever feel like you're stuck in this loop of rent payments, just watching your money vanish into thin air? It's time to turn that rent game around and start earning some serious rewards. That's where Built Rewards comes in. Built is breaking ground as the first rewards program that hooks you up with points on your rent. Even if you're still rocking the old school rent check vibes, Built Rewards has got your back. They'll mail the check for you. It's like having a personal rent paying assistant. Every month, pay your rent and watch the Built points roll in. Use points to jet off on a dream vacation. Put your points towards a flight or hotel stay with 500 plus airlines and 700,000 plus hotels and properties. You can also use your points towards a future rent payment or towards a future down payment on a home. Pay rent hassle-free through the Built Rewards app. Your rent game just got a major upgrade. Earn points by paying rent right now when you go to joinbuilt.com/capspace. That's joinbuilt, B-I-L-T, joinbuilt.com/capspace. Don't forget that /capspace URL. I think we've gotten to the point now in trades where draft picks have probably been undervalued, and perhaps we would have reached an equilibrium on it as it became clear that all these teams took big swings on players who weren't worth it and ended up giving up a lot of picks and ended up in the doldrums for years and years and years at a time for a payoff that wasn't worth it in the short term. And I think, you know, the Rudy Gobert trade will probably always be looked at as the absolute nadir for draft pick value in trades, maybe in NBA history, not involving Ted Stepien.
I mean,
but
we already erased that Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce trade.
I mean, I think the Gobert trade is worse than that one, even certainly at the time.
At the time, but I think, there's enough to talk about rather than relegating that Nets-Celtics trade.
Well, okay, but let me finish there. So I think now this is going to increase the value of draft picks. Again, especially if it's like, hey, now you need cheap contributors even more. And hey, the only way that you can even build up your salary if you're a good team is to draft and develop a player and then re-sign them. Another way, by the way, we can move on to this one, which I thought was pretty interesting, is that now you can do a rookie scale extension for 5 years, even if it's not the max. We can call it the Kenneth Faried rule.
Yes.
So yeah, and Dan, I look forward in the mock rookie extensions to getting your 5-year extension offer for the minimum.
Maybe we could call it the Giannis Antetokounmpo rule, because it eliminates, there was kind of a fun decision teams face sometimes of, would you rather have a guy for cheaper, but you can only do it for 4 years, or would you rather, because you want him long term, would you rather just pay him the max to get that fifth year? Where the Bucks made that decision with Giannis, it sounds like it was up to Giannis, right? But that was a negotiation between the teams that got a little tricky, and they would have, in hindsight, they would have wished they could pay him more per year and have him for five. It worked out because he re-signed, but it was a little more touch and go than they would have liked, of course.
Jalen Brown is in the exact same situation now for the Celtics, where they got him for less than the max. Also, speaking of rookie extensions, we're also going to get that the designated, you can only have X number of designated players on your team, which that was had first come into being because there's this concern that all the good teams were going to like assemble all the designated players that the poor small market teams had initially signed to their extensions. And so then it became clear that, what was it you called it? Unintended consequences again of that rule? Like, actually, A, screwed over teams that, you know, were just trying to trade for guys that weren't even that good, and B, it also screwed over the small market team that had to trade, say, an Anthony Davis, because the Pelicans literally couldn't trade Davis to the team that might have had the best package at the time, which was the Celtics. So
right.
I'm glad they got rid of that one. What do you think of, are you in favor of 5-year extensions for guys who don't make the max?
Yeah, that's fine. I was always intrigued by those Giannis-type decisions. And so just to kind of remove those, it takes away something that was interesting. But sure, it's fine. You know, to get a young player locked in long-term who you like, who's not a max player, that makes some sense. And I think the designated player aspect of it is just so overrated. Everybody's brought up the Cavaliers, and the Cavs are the one team where it might matter at all, because they already have Donovan Mitchell. They have Darius Garland on their rookie-scale designated players. Just to tell everybody, the current limit, I guess, it's still current, is you could have two designated players who are rookie scale designated players and two who are veteran designated scale players. You could have up to four on your team if they're the right type of designated player. And then on the rookie scale ones, you can only trade for one of them. Anyway, with the Cavs, like, there's such an easy workaround already where you can still give Evan Mobley the same max contract. You would have just had to re-sign him as a restricted free agent. You couldn't do it as an extension. It's only designated player as an extension.
Players don't seem to like that, though.
They don't like it, but how often are they in a position where your teammates with Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland on a young ascending team?
Yeah.
That's the type of situation where it's like, okay, I get it. And so this makes it a little easier for the Cavs, but I don't think it's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, for me, and we can talk about this as far as like the veteran extension limit being increased as well from 120% to 140%, that I don't like extensions as much as a lot of people. I'm not sure that they're great for the league. I mean, by the nature of an extension is that it's more likely to lead to a player being woefully underpaid or woefully overpaid. And the longer the extension goes, the earlier you can sign it before the guy would have been a free agent. I generally like to see players get paid what they're worth. I think that just makes for a better league in general. So I think this is either probably more likely, I would say, to lead to a lot of bargaining tokens for teams where players just really want the security and you get that fifth year. It's also going to lead to older draftees getting screwed because, you know, you come into the league at 22, you're 26 when you get that first extension, it's 5 years, you're 31, and now you're on the downside and you're not going to get another big contract. You're going to basically get one bite at the apple for a good contract for a lot of these guys if you add another year on.
So I mean,
I don't love it. I mean, I think it's like you would say why they could have done this as a restricted free agent, but the difference with the restricted free agent is he's already navigated another year. You have an understanding. So yeah, you can obviously give a guy a 5-year contract for less than the max as a restricted free agent, which you can't as a, or you couldn't before as a, in an extension. And I think they wanted to match those up like you noted, but I mean, this isn't a big deal, but I generally just don't like extensions that much.
I agree with you on your concerns of on extensions. As far as the older player, he doesn't have to sign for 5 years. That's a choice he makes.
Yeah, but it's also a choice that as we get into like the 120%, 140%, one question that I wondered was who was against increasing the amount that you could increase a veteran's extension, right? Because it used to be 120% of prior salary, or for the guys who were making like the minimum or less than the estimated average player salary, it was 120% of the estimated average player salary in the year the extension was signed. And now I assume it'll be 140% of all those. Well, again, that's an assumption, we'll see. And I was wondering, like, who was the one? Obviously the players would want there to be more extensions, so it probably would have had to be the owners who were arguing to like not just have it be, hey, you can pay a guy up to the max in an extension. And so I was like, why would the owners want that? Like, wouldn't they want to be able to extend guys too? And I think the best hypothesis I have is just that the owners wanted to be limited in what they can pay a guy so they can come to a guy and be like, hey, we're offering you the most that we can.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when the extent rules got tightened a little, they've been getting looser since, but it's because there were a bunch of bad extensions signed. And so the owners want protection from themselves a little bit. If we can just take one, as we get into veteran extensions,
yeah.
I know you talked about this with Keith Smith, and this is more theoretical, but as I'm thinking about, does 140% make more sense than 120%? And on just a basic level, I'm not sure it should be at all tied to your previous salary. Like,
no, of course it shouldn't. It has nothing to do with anything.
Right? Like, you shouldn't be punished as a team for signing a guy to a below market deal. Now you can't extend them. Yeah,
and nor should you be punished as a player for outplaying it. Like, you
right,
should,
right.
If anything, or you the should other get way. More of a chance to make up the money that you yeah. didn't make before.
Yeah. But I get owners wanting to protect themselves. And so if owners want to protect themselves and clearly have the leverage to get that, if it's not based on prior salary, it's what is it going to be based on? Like, whether you made an All-NBA team or not, we're adding to that. Like, nobody likes that. So if you want it based on something, I get why it's prior salary, but I could come up with a bunch of things that I think would be better than prior salary.
So this is, however, what the rule is. I'm in agreement with you there. So there have been a number of players who have been highlighted as guys where their teams just couldn't extend them. I did caution for a lot of these, a couple of these guys just got traded for, right? Like Sabonis, DeJounte Murray, OG Anunoby, or someone who's been on the trade block as well. Some of the most prominent examples here. And I was like, all right, let's see what's going to happen in the new CBA because these guys might be extendable. I'll admit 140%, maybe a little bit lower than I was expecting it to go up to. So for like some of these prominent guys, take us through what they could have made before, what they could make now, and you know whether that it would be palatable to them compared to waiting until free agency.
So I ran the numbers on four guys, and I know following along with all these numbers can be difficult. If you're a Dunked On Prime subscriber, I'm going to have these in the Daily Dunk, so you can look at those too. But we're going to talk about them. So these are all players who are heading toward 2024 free agency who would be in that 7 to 9 year experience range. So our projected max for these guys is going to be, if they re-sign with their current team, about $242 million. It's going to be about $187 million through the first 4 years. And the reason I like to split out the first 4 years is because that's the max length right now on an extension. As far as we know, that's not changing. And this is probably a good time to give a big caveat that we just want to make real explicit. We don't know all the changes, right? Just because we haven't heard a change on something doesn't mean it's not changing in the new CBA. It might just Absolutely. Be we haven't heard of it. So we're going to kind of, for these purposes, assume there's no change, but maybe we're going to find out there was a change. Anyway, The other thing we have learned is the way they're going to do cap smoothing, and there's still some questions of that, and I know we'll talk more about cap smoothing, but the cap is only going to go up 10% per year. So the largest possible amount these guys can earn in free agency is going to be about $260 million and about $201 million through the first 4 years. Okay, so projected free agency, let's just keep it through the first 4 years. No, if they go to free agency, they get a fifth year that's worth somewhere between $55 and $59 million. But for simplicity, let's keep it all first 4 years. Okay, so if they go to free agency, they can get somewhere between $187 million at projected and $201 million. Now, yeah, let's start with Jalen.
So what's that in annual per year value? That might be a little easier for people to digest.
How about we do starting salaries? That'll be simple, right? It's going to be the same 8% raises regardless. So let's do starting salaries in an extension versus free agency. So starting salaries, it's going to be $42 to $45 million in free agency. Okay. The four players I ran this for: Jaylen Brown, Domantas Sabonis, OG Anunoby, DeJounte Murray. So let's start with Jaylen Brown. Under the current system, it looked like his largest possible extension could be $37 million. Now, because of the increase, it could be $43 theoretically. It can't exceed that max. So if the max lands where it's projected at $42 million, it's going to be that $42 million. So essentially, he could sign a four-year max, a projected max extension. If the salary cap comes in higher than projected, possible, he might come in a little below that max. We're going to get to the caveat on this at the end. Domantas Sabonis, it was looking like $23 million. Now it's looking like $27 million. But again, that max projects to be $42 million. OG Anunoby was looking like $22 million, now looking like $26 million, but that $42 million projected max. DeJounte Murray was looking like $22 million. Now it's looking like about $25.5 million. Again, against that $42 million projected max. Now, for any of these guys, if they make an all-NBA team, well, not any of them, I guess, right? So we're limited to Jaylen Brown and OG Anunoby on this, but really we're talking about Jaylen Brown. You make an all-NBA team, you can get that designated player extension. That's something completely different. So if he makes that, wipe away all this math. For me, looking at this, if Jaylen Brown doesn't make it, I think because he's so much more of a viable all-NBA candidate, he probably goes into that last year and tries to make all-NBA so he can re-sign for that supermax. Yeah.
Well, and also he could always just sign this deal during the season too.
During next season.
Yeah.
Yeah, so all of these I'm projecting signing during... You're saying if it's not looking like he's going to make all-NBA? Like
yeah,
he goes in next year and
he's... Yeah, you know, he misses like 15 games at the start of the season or something like that.
That would almost eliminate him.
Yeah, he misses 17 games at the start of
18. The season. 18. He can miss 17. Yeah. So sure, that's a good point. But I think because of that, he won't sign it. And as I'm looking at these numbers for Sabonis and Anunoby, DeJounte Murray, in my estimation, it's not enough.
Yeah, maybe not. We'll have to see how those guys kind of end things up. DeJounte Murray could just be on the way to like, you know, two non-all-star seasons in a row. And he's like, you know what? An average annual value of $30 million a year, maybe that's not too terrible. So this would be interesting. I mean, I think Jaylen Brown, you're probably at enough where if you offer him that deal as the Celtics and he doesn't take it, you're like, we offer him. But I mean, again, like maybe he could try to go for making all NBA and get a larger deal, but it's still like, yeah, the rest of these guys, I would say, yeah, probably not enough.
Which is interesting because, like, the whole point is obviously can change for some other players too, some lower paid players, whether it's worth it for them or not. But all the focus of this rule is on these types of players, and I'm not sure it changes a single one.
No, that is really interesting. You mentioned the smoothing.
Yeah.
And I would actually probably say that is the biggest one.
Yeah, yeah.
And a 10% increase, that is not very big. Now, that may be indicative of that we're not going to get this batshit crazy increase in the TV deal rights deal anyway. But even if we did, you know, if the TV rights deal increases BRI by 30%, then after 3 years, you get the cap up there with your 10% increase anyway. Although there would certainly be a hope that you're going up close to that amount even before you get a big new TV deal. I think maybe there's an understanding that some of the local TV rate deals will be going down a little bit. But this is, we talked about smoothing, and I think everyone knew that that's what they were going to do this time because you had that big spike in 2016 and all the consequences there, including KD going to the Warriors. But yeah, 10% is less than I'd expected. And John, I've been like, oh yeah, 2025 free agency, time it then. But yeah, I mean, basically, if the max you're going to have is a 10% increase. And now I think, you know, part of that was maybe that's what they had before, right? It was locked in between, what was it, a 3% increase
and 10,
a 10% increase over the COVID stuff. And the owners kind of did the players a solid there to not reduce the cap a ton because BRI went down a ton. So maybe this is the owners coming back to the players and being like, hey, like we don't want to increase it by more than this. And to be clear, again, the players are going to get 51% of BRI. It's just going to come in the form of all the players being cut a check and the union will distribute it how they distribute it if salaries don't just pay the players enough on their own. So, but that's huge. Like, we're not going to have a crazy year in 2025. And I never thought it was going to be, oh yeah, the salary cap's going to go up by 40% in a year. But I thought it might go up by like 20%.
Yeah. My big question. So when the new TV deal kicks in, if everything's going right, that means players, based on their salaries, they're not going to get paid enough to cover their approximately 50% of the pie. How do they get the rest of their money? Like, how is that going to be distributed? Are they just going to give it to the union and say, you figure it out, which it could be based on how some other things work? Is it going to be proportional to salary? Is every player who plays a certain number of games or is service time in the league during that year, are they going to get equal checks? If it's anything we're near equal, that could be massive for lower paid players. Look at last time there was an overage. Like, this could really bring guys over from Europe, marginal players, where it's like, do I want to be a 15th man on an NBA team or do I want go to Europe? The math of where you might make more in Europe, that changes if there's a giant check coming at the end of the year.
It does. Yeah, that's a good point to make. And, you know, we could see that check for, you know, 2-3 year period, and it'll just go up by 10% until it equals out. Are you waking up with a ton of back pain or shoulder pain or neck pain? The number one reason probably to consider is your mattress. Maybe it's time for a new mattress. And I highly recommend that you check out Helix Sleep, which you can do risk-free with their 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty, depending on the model. And they have 20 unique mattresses, the award-winning Lux, the Ultra Premium Elite Collections. They have Helix Plus, which is designed for big and tall sleepers. Helix Kids, endorsed by child sleep experts. You can take their 2-minute sleep quiz. That's what my wife and I did over 10 years ago now. We still have a number of Helix Sleep mattresses that we've gotten over the years, and we are extremely satisfied with them even now, 10 years later. You might be like, I kind of want to try it out beforehand. Going to the store is not really going to give you any information. You're going to be like, lay down, like, oh, do I take off my shoes? Maybe I should leave my shoes on, but then I got to have my feet hanging off the mattress because I can't leave my shoes on and sleep normally on this mattress. And then you're going to feel awkward laying there after about 30 seconds. Like, you can't determine anything in 30 seconds. So you're going to have to take it home, and you might as well just get it delivered straight to your door and utilize that 100-night trial. And there's never been a better time to use Helix because they are offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. You can go to helixsleep.com/capspace. Use the remote /capspace. We talk about all the time here on the program. That's helixsleep.com/capspace. This is their best offer yet. It won't last long with Helix. Better sleep starts now. So I will be honest, I tend to pack on the pounds a little bit during the winter holiday season, not getting outside as much. So in springtime, I try to eat healthier, and I'm really excited to try Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Each meal is fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. This is going to be fantastic for me during the playoffs, when a lot of times I feel like I don't have time to eat healthy, and now I can choose from a number of their delicious but healthy options. I like to go keto. On occasion, they have that. They have vegan and veggie options as well. Here's what they've got for their keto weekly menu this week. Sun-dried tomato chicken with zucchini noodles, spicy poblano beef bowl with roasted broccoli, chicken piccata with cauliflower mash and broccoli, or if you want to go their chef's choice weekly menu, jalapeno lime cheddar chicken. That sounds fantastic. Greek lemon chicken with roasted potatoes. This all sounds really, really good. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up, heat, and savor the good stuff. And they're also celebrating Earth Day all month long as well. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/dunked50, special code for this one. That's factormeals.com/dunked50, and use the code dunked50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's code DUNKED50 at factormeals.com/DUNKED50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Next thing, did we mention that it's a 6-year deal with the mutual opt-out afterward? So technically 7 years, but basically six, because someone is always going to opt out.
I mean, wouldn't it be nice to think that all these changes they made to the system would make it so they're both happy and everybody's thriving and they don't opt out? I doubt it, but like that's got to be the goal with some of this, right?
It was kind of interesting as a quick aside that as we were getting down to the very end here, it was the owners were like, yeah, we will opt out. Adam Silver said that. And then the players were like, no, we won't opt out. Now, we'll stay in for the next year. I mean, I think that's all just PR and the players. There's no reason whether they're going to opt out or not. I mean, once you know the other side's going to opt out, there's no reason to say that you would opt out. Why not just be the good guys and say, no, we want to keep going?
Yeah, why did Silver say that? I didn't quite understand the move there.
I mean, I think it was just to like put a little extra pressure on it right at the end.
Yeah. No, well, it worked. I mean, no harm, no foul.
Yeah. But 6 years, I mean, that's a good amount. Like this mm-hmm. deal will now end likely after in the summer of 2029 is when this would expire. So we got labor peace until then, which is, and again, that's the number one thing I was concerned about because, you know, my business depends on NBA basketball actually being played. So I already went through a big stoppage once that no one saw coming. And that was pretty tough for everyone. So I'm glad that we're on it here for another 6 years. All right, next thing. What do you want to talk about here? I guess let's wrap a bow around what's going to happen with the luxury tax.
Yeah. So this is all very vague, at least this part. Woj says there's a less punitive system for teams at the lower end of the luxury tax. So that could mean basically two things come to mind. One, the tax rate's going to be lower if you're just a little over the luxury tax. Two, more importantly, you're going to get a cut of the luxury tax money that previously had gone to non-tax paying teams. So it's not that sharp drop of now I'm $1 into the tax, I'm not getting this. What was it this year? Like $12 million it was looking like? Somewhere in that range. Like you lose that for going $1 million into the tax. It seemed like an easy fix.
Yeah, and I think I'm not sure whether he was differentiating that between the other reporting that the luxury tax brackets are going to increase now at the same rate that the cap does. I'm guessing those are two separate things mm-hmm. from what we can tell. But that also obviously makes it less punitive for teams at the lower end of the tax. But it sounds like we'll still be at the $5 million bands for next year, and then it'll increase. Or maybe it'll increase off of the $5 million with the increase in the cap starting next year. But that's something that KP suggested a few months ago that I hadn't even thought of, and I was like, as soon as he said it, I was like, yeah, that's just so obvious that, you know, with these $5 million bands came in when the cap was $58 million at the end of the 2011 CBA negotiations, and now it's more than double that, and it's still the same bands, even though player salaries have doubled and all the exceptions have doubled and all that. So yeah, I mean, but I don't think they're gonna like go from $5 million to, you know, they're not gonna make up for all the time they lost with the cap increasing and those not increasing, but at least it will now increase some.
I'm not sure how much you can answer this. Are you, do you know something there? Because that was one of my big questions was
guessing.
Yeah, what are the brackets starting at? I'm not as convinced as you that it's going to stay at $5 million and go from there. I think there could be a change to the initial brackets.
Okay. Well,
I'm not making a guess one way or the other, but I'm not convinced.
Yeah, I mean, my default at this point is if we didn't hear anything about it, it's staying the same. So that's okay. That we know everything.
You didn't listen to my caveat.
Yeah, which was what?
Which was if we don't know about it, it might be changing. We just might not have heard yet.
Yeah, but that's my default as of now. Obviously, I will change that if I find out something else. I'm all we can go on right now is what's actually been reported. Yeah, so we got this second apron thing. I mean, that's obviously huge. This is actually another big one that we haven't gotten to yet. And this, I'm annoyed that there's been so little reporting on this. This idea that there will be new spending and trade opportunities for teams at the middle and lower spectrum of the payrolls, including larger trade exceptions and new and expanded exceptions to the salary cap. Now, a couple of those were the room exception going up, which I think is great. Like, why should a team that uses cap room not be able to spend as much as a team that uses, say, the mid-level? Like, you know how we were always like, oh, yeah, it just makes sense for them to stay over because then they would lose the mid-level. Like, no, it would be great if you could just spend all of your cap room and then still have something akin to the mid-level. It won't be quite as much, but it'll at least be like pretty close to that now, the room exception. So I think that's really good. You know, and if you have opportunities to spend in that year, like why not let teams do it? And there's just there because you have more of these restrictions once you really get higher in the bands. I think the thinking, which makes a ton of sense, and I, you know, this is stuff that I talked about with people. I think Keith and I even talked about it as well, of just shouldn't, like, if you have these limits at the top, why are you going to have all these limitations below that? Like, if teams want to spend a bunch all at once to like get up to those limits, all right, then they'll just hit those limits faster, but who cares?
Just to put some numbers on the exceptions changing, yes. According to Shams, the mid-level exception is going to go up by 7.5% and the room exception is going to go up by 30%. Now, it's not clear exactly what that means. Is that like the current numbers going up by those percentages, but the salary cap's also going up or what? But there's some, I'm going to give you just a little bit of a baseline of what I think that means. So currently, the mid-level exception is about 8% of the salary cap. That's the non-taxpayer mid-level exception. The taxpayer mid-level exception is about 5%, and the room exception is about 4%. So if those numbers increase by 7.5%, 7.5%, and 30%, then we're looking at 9%, 6%, 6%, getting to, like you said, where the taxpayer MLE is closer in the range to the room MLE. Interestingly, though, if you know, because I think a lot of times you get a sense for what the mid-level exception is and you kind of get used to it. This 8% number, it used to be 9, 10, 11% in the earlier part of the 2000s, the mid-level exception, what that was of the cap. So it's not...
That's the increase...
So the mid-level exception currently is about 8% of the salary cap. In 2005, 4, 3, 2, it was 11% of the cap. So this sounds like it's going to make it 9%. So it's somewhat at a low point right now of how the mid-level exception works, and this might just kind of be getting it back more toward the norm.
Yeah, and again, the feeling being, hey, like, you know, you can spend more on a mid-level contract. That's good. Also, you kind of would run into this issue where it's like, okay, you're either getting the mid-level or you're getting cap room and you're getting $20 million. And there wasn't really a way to be like, oh, hey, like my market value is above the mid-level. You kept running into these issues. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's great to increase it. And again, like, hey, if you'd use the mid-level, you're hard cap. So you can only, you might be able to spend more on that player, but you can only increase your own salary as a team by so much before you run into that hard cap anyway. So why not let that mid-level be a little bit bigger? I also really like this, that there is now a second round pick exception. We'll have to see how big that is.
And how many years?
Yeah, but teams will no longer, I assume it'll be 4 years, but teams no longer need to dip into the mid-level, which then, you know, prevents veterans from getting paid the full mid-level. Sorry, JaVale McGee. you gotta leave room for Jaden Hardy. I think there's really no reason why there shouldn't be an exception for second rounders. Also, I mean, we've seen the Lakers repeatedly blow this with Jordan Clarkson. Now they're doing it with, then they did it with Taylor Horton Tucker. Now they're doing it with Austin Reeves, like just giving a guy a 2-year deal because I guess they just didn't feel like they could use any part of the mid-level or something. And that then just, who would they have used it on Reeves rookie year?
Is that when they signed Kendrick Nunn to, weirdly, a little bit less than the full mid-level? Did he get the full mid-level? I feel like
it wasn't like $1 million less, so it wouldn't have been enough to sign.
Right, but it wasn't enough less, right? There was some team that did that where it wasn't enough less to actually sign somebody. They just saved a few bucks.
So this will now help teams prevent that, hold on to these second round guys for a little bit longer. We're also going
to
see.
Well, I want to stick on that for a sec because it comes kind of counter to a lot of the direction we're moving, where you say, well, why not do that? Well, why not do that is because it punishes teams that don't have these exceptions available or that want to use them on something else, right? This allows teams to spend more. You can still use your mid-level exception on something else, keep increasing your team salary and still have money left over to sign a multi-year deal. Where it works currently is you need the non-taxpayer mid-level to sign a guy for 4 years. You need a chunk of the taxpayer mid-level to sign a second round pick for 3 years. Otherwise, you're stuck with 2 years through the probably the minimum exception. And so this is one of the changes. I like it, but it's the opposite direction of most of these changes.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I think I want to move now to two-way contracts. There will now be a third two-way contract slot per team. I wonder what that's going to do for like the overall number of games that each two-way player can play, or that you can get overall from two-way players, and whether we could see again this issue like with the Warriors this year, where they avoided signing a 15th guy and used two-way guys to still get enough bodies to play. Yeah, I'm sure they'll come up with something that will address potentially that issue. Mm-hmm. I just don't care for even more two-way slots, because I've noticed that there's a reduction in the quality of play, because when teams really are injured, or frankly even when they're tanking, you can't sign any good players anymore because they're all on rosters because of two-way. Like, you're picking the, what would it be, the 550th best player or something, or the 500th best player, the 510th best player instead of the 450th best player. Like, that probably matters to some degree.
Yeah.
So I'm not really in favor of there being yet another two-way contract. Also, we've seen a lot of guys in that system get screwed. Hopefully they're, at least if they're doing this, you get a real qualifying offer now as a two-way guy. Mm-hmm. And we haven't heard anything about that yet, and we'll get to that. There's some changes in that for regular restricted free agents we talk about in a second. But if it's just the same deal where you're just letting more players who break out get screwed, or have to sign, you know, the Lou Dort 4-year Sam Hinkie special after you're like already starting and you're on a two-way, like, not in favor of that.
Yeah, I have a lot of problems with how the two-way works in that regard. Share all your concerns. Counterpoint, though, I think it's good and healthy for the league to work toward a point where these minor league affiliates are full of players that are on your team. I think that would increase fan interest in that, when you know those are your guys and not just some like random minor league players. And so I think this is kind of a move in that direction.
Restricted free agency. Now, they've agreed to help restricted free agents some. I think this is actually the bigger thing, that there's just a 10% increase in qualifying offers. And recall, the reason that matters is because that's the 1-year deal that they have to offer you if they're going to make you a restricted free agent. You may unilaterally accept that once it is offered. It can only be pulled up until July 13th, and then you have still until October 1st to accept it as well. And so that is some leverage for restricted free agents. Say, okay, you don't give me enough, I'll take the qualifying offer, and then I'm going to be totally unrestricted next season, and also you won't be able to trade me unless I accept it. So that's useful. I mean, another 10%, like, baby steps. It's not amazing. They have reduced the matching period from 48 to 24 hours. However, Dan, I find that, I mean, that's nice, but everything yeah. done by the time you can actually sign these guys anyway, like, that doesn't really matter. Like, you're still tying your cap space up for the entirety of the time that you're going to be making offers and finding free agency's done after like 2 days these days.
Yeah, the 24-hour, I mean, that's just moving toward the reality of the present. It used to be like, what, a month or something? And then went to like 10 days and then a week. Like, it's just technology changing. You don't have to mail a letter letting the other team know you signed somebody to an offer sheet. It could be an hour at this point.
Yeah, but that's probably, I mean, and every little bit helps. I think the increase in the qualifying offer, where more players be like, no, now it's like tipping the scales a little bit more to where, hey, I'm willing to take that qualifying offer.
I got a trivia question for you. I think people underestimate how powerful the qualifying offer is, and including some restricted free agents. There's only been one player ever to sign a standard contract qualifying offer and then the following year re-sign with that same team. Who is it? And while you're thinking about it, I'm going to filibuster just for a second and just kind of make the point of, when you sign the qualifying offer, you're basically nuking your future with that team, and therefore that team is nuking its future with you. Like, you have so much control, it torches everything. Teams should be very wary of you signing a qualifying offer, and they've got to be even more wary now because those qualifying offers are worth more money. And I'm also curious whether that's going to be in relation to an increase in the rookie scale also. No reporting on that or anything. They did the big increase in the rookie scale on the last CBA, so I'm not necessarily expecting that, but because the qualifying offer has been based so much on what your rookie scale contract is, I'm just curious if that's part of it, though not expecting that. Okay.
So I can't think of who it was. I mean, I think there are not that many guys who for whom signing the qualifiers worked out great. Like Greg Monroe, Ben Gordon are two that I can think of, but there's not that many of them. Who is the one guy who re-signed? I'm going to kick myself as soon as you tell me who it is.
Spencer Hawes with the 76ers.
Oh, I'm not going to kick myself. I don't even remember that.
And I like every time you think it might happen, like I thought like Bruce Brown, it might happen. You could see the circumstances of why he took it with the Nets and why they valued him. Nope, now he's on the Nuggets. It just never works out for
teams.
Well,
actually, no, I do. There's another one. You're forgetting one.
Yeah.
Matthew Dellavedova took a qualifying offer and then re-signed with the Cavs. Is that right?
I'm going to have to check your math on that.
Maybe. Oh, no. Maybe he did a qualifying offer and then he left as a restricted free agent the next year. That's what it was. All right, good. Yeah,
because he signed with the Bucks and LeBron wished him well and said, we're not even waiting for the magic window. Congratulations on your big contract with the Bucks.
He would just went through the restricted free agency process twice.
Right.
But the second time he actually left. Yeah.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Okay, where do you want to go to next, sir?
All right, well, you want to do, let's do awards. Because if we're on trivia, I got another trivia question for you. I looked this one up. Okay. So the new award rule is players have to play at least 65 games. And a lot of details we don't know. Woj says, quote, the 65-game minimum does come with some conditions. So
you have to play at least 1 minute and 1 second in each of the 65 games.
Great. So guys, I'm going to check out after 102.
You're not going to see the Jrue Holiday go in, get the games played bonus, and immediately leave the He'll play 1 minute first.
So I don't know if this is going to apply to every single award and honor. I mean, is it going to apply to like the all-rookie second team? Because a lot of times those guys don't make it. So here's my trivia question for you. Right now, there are 40 major awards and honors. You got the five big ones, MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, Rookie of the Year, Most Improved Player, Sixth Man of the Year. You got 15 All-NBA slots. You got 10 slots on each of all defense and all rookie. It used to be less. Those teams were smaller. You got to kind of figure this. In NBA history, how many players have earned one of those honors and not played 65 games or the equivalent? I did it prorated on the season. Some seasons used to be shorter. Lockouts earlier.
In NBA history,
how many times has this come up? Is this a big problem, a little problem? Is this common? Is it uncommon? How big of a shakeup are we looking at?
Well, I will say before I guess that I think it's becoming more common recently.
I got some numbers on that for you too.
Okay. All right. Well, so I'm going to say this is for any of these, huh?
We just did the 75th anniversary. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's happened. I mean, obviously, simply the fact that you're asking this indicates that it's a lower number than you might think. I'm going to say it's happened 17 times.
170.
Oh, okay.
170. This is not a small change. This is not just like, oh, here and there are going to be players who don't win awards who would have previously. This is a massive difference.
I went for the trivia answer in the wrong direction.
But you're right. It is more common. We're going to look at it since 1989, sort of as the modern era. That's when the NBA went to a second team for all rookie, a third team for all NBA. That's when it started having these 40 honors per year. So it could be up to, you know, there's 40 guys earned. In the first 26 years of this, the high mark for guys being sub 65 games was 6. Not a single year was there more than 6. Each of the last 5 years, there's a low of 7. The last 5 years working back, it's been 11, 11, 9, 7, and 8. It is more of a thing now.
Yeah.
For better or worse. I don't like this change. We've talked about it some. We can talk about it more. I'm not in favor. I think it undermines the the credibility of awards. I think it voters already consider games. I think the unintended consequences, there's that word, of if a player tries to push through a mild injury and gets hurt worse, this could completely backfire. That's the worst case scenario. I get what they're going for. There's a slim chance it could work, that players play more often now. You get your top players on the court more without any negative repercussions. Slim chance that could work. I don't think the odds are high enough to be worth it.
Yeah, my guess would be, I mean, the only ones that people care about are the major awards anyway. I mean, All-NBA, MVP, all the stuff that makes you eligible to get paid more. Those are the ones that I think people really care about getting. You know, and then Rookie of the Year probably matters. Maybe Sixth Man, maybe Most Improved.
But Defensive Player of the Year, those guys in the running for that are super proud of that.
Well, yeah, I included that already because that can make you
eligible. Oh, yeah, good point.
But yeah, I mean, it's just, I think this is dumb now. We're adding the midseason tournament, like we're adding more games as of right now. This would, I mean, my biggest disappointment, not that I expected it, so maybe I shouldn't say it was disappointment, but is that, you know, we're still going to be 82 games. There's not really any kind of provision to reduce the schedule at all. You know, I was hoping that we might do 78, and like, I think that clearly with the new TV deal coming up, that just nobody wanted to rock the boat. They wanted to just keep adding stuff. And they've added a lot of stuff, by the way, since the last TV contract, right? They extended the season by a week, so there's like another week of national games, and they also added the play-in, so there's like another week of really interesting nationally televised games there too. So there's basically two more weeks of national TV than there was when they negotiated the deal the last time.
A week and a half. And now they've scaled back the length. It went from 170 days to 177. Now it's down to 174. So, but yes, the play-in's obviously the huge one.
Yeah, so curbing load management. Yeah, I mean, it is teams that push for this mostly, you would imagine. Now, one thing that I am happy about, at least, is that all NBA teams are going to be positionless now. So that might actually make the quality of the teams, that'll make up maybe some for the fact that like some of the positions are weaker. My guess actually would be that like forward is probably going to be get squeezed out the most. Like that's where we've had the most weakness, probably, I would say, is like third team forward. That's always where I feel like there are fewer qualified candidates than a guard. Now, I mean, the other thing, Dan, another unintended consequence, right? What if, I think this could be something where, for example, guards just put up more stats generally than bigs do. Bigs are more important on defense, which is harder to measure. What if the whole team is just going to be guards now, right? Like that could be big guys. It could just be harder for them now to get paid. Like that could be an unintended consequence of this as well. I mean, in favor of the position list, but you know, the voters could just be seduced by points per game and then
it could go the
guys.
It could go the other way where they're just seduced by you know, some of these advanced stats where bigs perform real well if there's not a positional adjustment.
Are the advanced stats that sexy? Are they really that seductive?
Back-to-back reigning MVP Nikola Jokic suggests yes. Let's talk about
the guy who's averaging a triple-double this year, that guy.
Let's talk about forwards just for a second, okay? If this rule were in place last year, no players changed their behavior at forward. This is just a good example of what we're looking at. Or maybe a little bit extreme. I cherry-picked to make a point. All right, forward. First team, Giannis and Jason Tatum. They're both fine. Second team, Kevin Durant played 55 games. He is out. DeMar DeRozan staying on the second team. We've got Pascal Siakam bumping up from third team to second team. The other third teamer is LeBron James. He is out. So now we need to have two more forwards. Leader in points who didn't make it, Jimmy Butler, only played 57 games. He can't make it. All right, Jaylen Brown, I guess, because here's the thing. We don't know who the voters, all these voters who voted for Kevin Durant and LeBron and Jimmy Butler would have voted for. Jaylen Brown got 3 voting points. He is now the third team forward. We have one spot to go still. There's two other guys who got a vote. It's Desmond Bane and Chris Middleton. Like, how do you feel about an All-NBA team last year with Desmond Bane? Does that reflect the league that you saw? Does anybody care about All-NBA awards when that's how it works?
Yeah, hopefully they won't be stuck with it not being positionless going in that direction. But no, we'll see what happens. 60, I think actually, like, if they had made it 58,
yeah,
I would feel better about it.
My list would have been a lot shorter than 170.
To win, to, And that's what it is to qualify for the scoring title. So why should it? I mean, this is, Woj, I thought, put it, like, he wasn't a big fan of this either. It seemed like, and I think he noted that this is basically just PR. It's just an attempt to show that they're doing something about it. But if it's just going to be PR, maybe they could have made it like slightly more toothless than this. The other thing I'll note too is, and this is goes back to my disappointment with the schedule, part of the reason why everyone constantly talks about awards, and I mean, I think it's really interesting, like we do it once a month, it's a really interesting show, but you know, we do one of our 24 shows a month is about awards, you know, I'd say some other national podcasts, and then when you look at TV and stuff, you know, what is, and like, you know, SportsCenter or whatever else, like, is like 1/3 of all discussion in the league about awards. Like the MVP, it's like, well, why is that? Well, because the individual games don't matter. You need to just focus in on these like season long narratives, because the analysis isn't, oh, hey, like this game was unbelievable. That's 1 out of 82 that, you know, maybe 3% of your audience was watching last night, right? So if the games meant more, then not everyone would have like this huge hard on to talk about awards.
Yeah, that's a great point.
In season tournament, can we move on? Or do you have anything else you want to say on the awards front?
I feel like I did, but I don't know what it was. So let's move on.
No, I mean, I like those stats. Those are good stats to...
I'll have some of those details in the dunks also for those examples of which they were. And I mean, like no more Patrick Ewing as Rookie of the Year. No more Kyrie Irving as Rookie of the Year. Like you got to go down. I actually think that year, like Kawhi Leonard was the top finisher of all people who had played enough games. Like it's a significant change. Irony of ironies.
Yeah. The load manager himself.
It's a lot of big changes throughout NBA history if you retroactively apply this. And of course, like the hope is that some of these guys who are a couple games short would have pushed through. I know the other. I talk long enough that I came up with it. So you said absolutely correctly that it's often teams pushing for this. Kawhi Leonard is probably the exception, but otherwise teams are making this decision. Well, now teams have a giant incentive to hold out a guy so he can't make all NBA, he can't make the Supermax, except over and over we see teams bend to players on this where they want the hype of the guy, like it's worth it to them. They promote them for All-Star, even if that increases their salary. Like teams generally go the other way. But do you see any possibility for acrimony here where, hey, a guy's being held out more than he thinks is right because he wants to make all NBA and he wants to get the Supermax, and whether or not the team is doing it to protect the player long term for legitimate reasons or has this ulterior motive, like do you see that coming up?
Not really, because okay. I think teams want the guy to make it so they can pay him and not lose him.
Yeah, yeah.
I think in some of those circumstances, you shouldn't want to be paying this guy the Supermax, but I think generally there aren't that many players who are going to make. Now, I think it could maybe be more of something if the guy has signed a designated rookie extension, and it's one of these ones where like it could be 25%, it could be 30%.
Yeah.
That's the one where I see it.
Yeah.
But because you can't sign one of these contingent extensions for a designated player, it's just you either sign it or you don't.
For the veteran.
Designated player veteran extension. I don't think it would happen. I mean, I don't think there are that many guys where it's like, oh man, oh shit, he qualified. Now we have to pay him more. That sucks. Like you also, I mean, the guy's going to be a free agent anyway. Like it's not a restricted free agent contract. It hasn't already been signed. So
yeah.
I don't think that's as much of an issue. And I think also we've seen like the Jrue Holiday thing, for example, with the bonus, like teams are going to work with the guy to
this to is pay far him more, if it's, yeah. far more money than the bonus.
Yeah, of course.
And the way it counts against the cap for, but yeah, I that fourth year one, that's a great point. That's where you're going to have to watch for it if it happens at all.
Okay. A couple of smaller things here. Marijuana is no longer prohibited. They had pretty much reduced the testing to the point where it didn't matter anyway. But I think that's, it's legal in a lot of states. Totally fine with that. I think it's also, frankly, like for athletic performance, it's if you got to pick either that or alcohol, I think you know which one you'd want to choose if you got a game the next day. The age limit. No changes.
The only surprise is that people are at all surprised. The owners wanted it so they could get an concession. The players wanted it so they could get a concession. That's like an impossible thing to overcome.
And the reporting behind this was that they're just, and this actually even came out before the deal was done, that this wasn't going to be a part of it. And I think this is true, that there isn't a moral imperative as much anymore now that there's NIL in college, now that you have other avenues like Overtime Elite, even the NBA itself provides employment for the guys who truly were, you know, might have been able to make the leap and like actually contribute that year. I also think that in terms of at the NBA level, we're probably not losing that much by not having high schoolers actually playing for NBA teams. And the list of high school, like, or I guess we should say 18-year-olds who could have been in the league and contributing. I mean, that's maybe like 10 guys in all of history where like, oh man, we really missed out on having the guys.
No. Ben Taylor,
Luka, LeBron, yeah. Wembanyama, like those guys would have been cool to have them this year, but I think it's fine to wait. Like nobody wanted to be in high school gyms either. And I agree. Like I very much was against it back when your only option was just going to college and just having to chill or like get paid under the table for a year. Now that's not the case anymore. I don't feel the imperative for it. I mean, I probably would have liked to have seen it. Maybe it would have made my life harder trying to scout the draft. So personally, but you know, I still think it would have been nice to have guys in if they were, but I guess, you know, the nature of the draft is like all these guys are getting drafted for potential anyway. If it was really a case where it's like, okay, we're only gonna let the guys in who really can play right now and there are some way to do that, which I don't think there is, I would be in favor of that. So I think this is fine. Like I'm kind of, my thinking on this has evolved with the ability of these guys to get paid at the lower levels now.
Ben Taylor had a really good podcast on like the best super young players, like the best age 18 seasons, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I did not realize how thin the crop was of 18-year-olds. If you go back and listen to that, I'm thinking basketball.
Oh yeah, I do recommend, I mean, like that. even Kobe, his first yeah. year was not a, I mean, it's basically like I think KG started like the second half of his year, his rookie year. LeBron, I think like maybe Moses was okay. I mean, there's not that many guys.
I agree with you on the moral imperative not being as strong. I do think there still is one though, that the NBA has this monopoly in a lot of ways. The NBA is allowed to act in ways that other businesses are not, like teams are allowed to act in a way other businesses are not, because they have collective bargaining, because ostensibly there's a union representing the players. These 18-year-olds coming out of high school, they're not represented in this. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's right. I understand why it happens, but I think it's wrong. And I would support anybody trying to challenge this in court. I think they would have a chance of winning. It's obviously hard because of the timing of it, because you can go.
I don't think they would. Didn't like Maurice Claret like lost basically that case, right? Because it was collectively bargained.
That was football, and that was a while ago. I'm not saying I would guarantee success, but I would. I know who I'd be rooting for in that case, and I think they would have a chance, because I do think the union has some duty to represent potential and future members in this situation where they're.
Yeah. Now the union also has a duty to preserve the quality of play in the league and help mm-hmm. grow the pie mm-hmm. as well. And to me, now it's reached the point where because there is the ability for these guys to get NIL deals and or play professionally elsewhere or whatever and still get paid.
Yeah.
And not just be, you know, making, you know, a $25,000 scholarship or whatever it was back then. That to me now reduces the moral imperative enough that other concerns such as just let's not waste a roster spot on this guy who clearly just can't even like tie his shoes to get into an NBA game take over.
Well, that's to me why the best solution for the league, if they can get away with basically whatever they want, clearly, like why not just let the high schoolers be draft eligible, but they're not eligible to play in the NBA for a year. But then if you want to go through the NBA draft route, now you can play in our minor league or you can play college. Yeah. You can play wherever you want. But, like we'll have your draft rights. Like, why not?
Here's the other thing too, Dan, like anyone who actually would be good enough to play, the NBA is offering them employment. I'm sure they would offer anyone good enough the chance to play for G League Ignite and make a pretty good salary. Maybe not.
Sure.
You know, but what you would make as a
I'm saying, why not let those guys, prospect, but, why not let yeah. those guys go through the draft too? Like why wait a year?
Yeah. Well, because I think it's also not good to just have your first round draft pick be someone who just like can't play that year.
It's a choice that's teams
not
can make
good for a team. Yeah, but I mean that's just generally not good. Like, and it would be a rational choice for a team to make, but just for like fans. Like
I think there'd be more fan interest, right? Like, who's watching? How many people are watching minor league games for Scoot Henderson right now? Like, ahead of the draft, you might look back and look at video and try and assess him. But who's watching the games night to night? If he were drafted by the Rockets last year, Houston fans would be watching all those games.
Maybe that's reasonable. I think more in aggregate, though, it might not be great.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
But this is very interesting, though, going back to the draft. The league's been pushing for this for a long time. The new CBA requires players attending the combine to undergo physical exams that will be distributed to select teams based on player projection. So players that are kind of in the range that these, or teams that are in the range that these guys are projected to be drafted. Now, players attending the draft combine, could you just still not go to the combine? This is unclear. Does everyone have to go now? I would imagine this has some amount of teeth because the whole reason is guys didn't want to get drafted by the Kings, so they wouldn't send them their physical. Or maybe what it is like, oh, hey, you want to go to the combine and like get measured and all that and get medicals for some teams. Well, no, now you don't have control of that anymore. If you want to do this, it has to get sent to everyone in this range, not just the ones that you want, so you can steer the guy this way. So, but whether like there's some penalty now if you don't come to the combine, like that all remains to be seen. But this is obviously, this is a win for the league to get this.
Are you sure? Could I say unintended consequences again? If there's not some requirement to go to the combine or penalty for
yeah, then
attending,
maybe just nobody goes.
Nobody goes to the combine.
I would imagine.
Far fewer, right? It's going to be like late first rounders and second rounders and those mid first rounders. Like the top players, sometimes they go just for interviews for convenience for everybody. Now it's going to be slightly more inconvenient for the teams, but like the interviews with the other top teams, those will still get done.
I would imagine this has enough, like they wouldn't have bothered to do this unless like the top prospects are going to have, they have some way to make them do it, but we'll see. I don't think, because I'm guessing to get this, the NBA had to give something up. Like we had some of these wins for the players that were kind of unanticipated, like this BRI thing, like, you know, a few of these other, you know, increase in the mid-level, like definitely some the increase in the extensions, and some of those might not have even been anticipated. So this is a win for the owners. Like the owners clearly must have had to give up something to get this. We don't know exactly what that is, but I do think it's interesting that this got done. And I would say for the players, again, we don't know exactly what the quid pro quo was, but ultimately this isn't something, you know, players are generally pro movement and pro selecting your destination, owners are not. And surely, like, the owners are the clientele in the CBA for the negotiations. It's not teams, it's not GMs, it's the owners. And I would imagine that is very embarrassing to certain owners to just never be able to draft guys or have to take this huge risk because you didn't have the medicals. And there was just this overt way to like prove that guys didn't want to go to your franchise. So obviously that was really vexing for owners.
That's where I have some hesitation whether this has teeth. When you say certain owners, like how many owners really care about this? How many owners have been embarrassed by this? And is this just in there to placate them of like, hey, we know this is a priority for you, and so we got you something. The guys who come to the combine, they got to do it, and there's not the teeth. Maybe. It's just the theory of how it could have come in without there being more to it.
Yeah, but in any event, I would say, and this, I want to transition to this last point before we start talking about the in-season tournament, is ultimately, like, the players using this thing, which, yeah, you know, it matters, it's a system issue, it matters to certain owners, but using something like this to actually get paid more money, if that's what it was, or to just, or whether it's just into, or get more flexibility elsewhere, like, I think that's good negotiating. I think that you took this thing that was really a burn guy's size, but didn't ultimately matter to how much money everyone is making, to actually like get more money out of the pocket of the owners for something like this, that's a win. I consider that to be pretty good.
Yeah, especially because the people you're throwing under the bus aren't even voting members of the union yet. Once again, it's the players who are coming into the league who are suffering the consequences, so that the guys currently in the league can reap more benefits.
But all those guys do have agents who, you know, I'm sure were pushing against this. But those agents now are presumably going to have more ways to get their clients paid. So in-season tournament, what do you think?
I've got a lot of skepticism. You've alleviated some of it. I think they did it in a way that might work because the final game is not going to count toward the regular season, or the final game will be the only one that doesn't count toward the regular season. So teams can't just completely duck this. It's still your games. It's still your schedule. I'm hopeful it works. I'd love to have more competitive games in the regular season, but the Giant, well, I don't know. I think they did something very smart by including it in the regular season games. That alleviates a lot of my skepticism. The big difference between this and the play-in tournament, I see them compared so often. The end goal of an NBA season is a championship, and we measure teams by how far they advance toward that. It doesn't have to be championship or bust, but it's, okay, the Kings got to the playoffs. We're going to celebrate that. That absolutely should be celebrated, but it's a thing that moves toward a championship. Advancing through the play-in tournament advances you toward a championship. We're all measuring toward that end goal. The in-season tournament as its own thing, it doesn't fit that. It's very different. I'm still somewhat skeptical whether it's going to be a success.
Do you like watching international basketball?
Depends. I don't work for NBC anymore, so I don't have to say that I love watching the Olympics. You're talking about national teams. I do enjoy watching the Olympics, so that was
true. Yeah. Well, I do. Yeah, this is what I would say, and this has been my position before, and I said this to Danny. If you have good basketball players playing hard, I'm very interested in watching that game. I'm interested in analyzing it, and whether it's like, oh, this matters for a championship or not, like that's. Ultimately, it's a great game that you want to watch. It's an entertainment product. Like, yes, knowing the whole thing about, oh, advancing towards the championship and like, what, like, you want the game that you are watching to mean something. And so, and you want the reason that sports in and of itself is so interesting is like, hey, wow, these guys really want it. They're competing as hard as they can. That's what we want to see in sports, is guys competing as hard as they can. So if this is incentivized to get guys to compete as hard as they can, and it's the best guys in the NBA, even if it's not the best guys in the NBA, honestly, like if it's just two, you know, the sixth and seventh best team in the NBA in a single elimination format, really trying, the coaches are playing guys 45 minutes, they're breaking out junk defenses, they're scouting the shit out of these guys beforehand, it feels like it's this crucible, I will absolutely watch. So my only concern with this, I shouldn't say my only concern, my main concern is, are the players involved going to play hard?
Yep.
If it is, in fact, $500,000, Shams has reported that. Woj said today, we don't know how much that is. I don't know if that's because Shams reported it and he's like, well, we don't know that that's true, or Shams might have jumped the gun on it or something. I had posited that it should be $1 million per player because I wanted it to be, and that everyone gets it. I like that it's going to be the same amount for every player on the team because I thought there could be this component of, hey, LeBron James is like, oh yeah, I'm going to win an extra $1 million for this guy in the end of the bench, and like how cool that would be to like for everyone to celebrate and stuff. And like, I think that's something where all these guys, you know, like CJ McCollum is in the union, and like, you know, there's this feeling of like, oh yeah, we're so player empowerment, and like we care about all you guys, and like, you know, we're a family. Like, you could really get that storyline, I think, would be really interesting to basically like allow the, you know, the two-way guys to double his salary or something like that if he's eligible for this. So 500k is not quite enough to me for that. I think $1 million would be worth, even, and I think even the guys who are making 30 million a year, 40 million a year, like, you know, $1 million for, you know, I mean, because this is only going to be three extra games, right? Like only eight teams make this thing.
Well, no. So you play three games. So I guess my understanding of it is all of those games will count toward regular season except for the championship game. And that's one of the reasons why I think it could work, because it's only one extra game that doesn't count toward the regular season. And by the time you get two teams for the championship game for this, I kind of figured they'll care. Like, it's just one more game. You win that one game, you win this whole title, I think teams will care. I guess one of the questions I have is, so the games you start with, it's going to be pool play, and then those single elimination games, but those are regular season games, basically. Do you think teams will care about those more than they do a typical regular season
game? Yeah, I was gonna say the same thing. That'll be interesting to see. I think, particularly because it's at the beginning of the season,
is that something we know?
It is possible. Well, I mean, the tournament is going to be in December, so it's got to be, you know, it's not going to be...
I guess Woj says starting in November, so it's not necessarily the first games. You might get a little bit of a warm-up.
I see.
My guess is the pool games. I'm going to guess that teams don't care more about those and might care more about the ones classified as single elimination because you're still going to have to play other games if you lose those. That's going to be my guess. They don't care about the pool, but if you end up in the single elimination part with seven other teams total, then you start to care. And if you get to a championship game that doesn't count, you'll care just because it's one game.
I think that there will be definitely certain teams that will treat the pool play games as more important.
Are those teams going to be good enough to make a difference with that, even if they care?
Yeah, maybe so. But, you know, I mean, it could be it's a thing where it's like, okay, where it's the second night of a back-to-back. Which one is Kawhi going to play in? Okay, he's going to play in the one that's for the pool play. Okay.
Is the NBA going to try and prioritize not having these games involved to be back-to-backs? And maybe you're willing to take more back-to-backs later in the season.
Nope. I think that could also be true as well. We'll just have to see how they end up scheduling out. I also wouldn't have minded if make the championship game, that 83rd game, count in the standings, but only for the winner.
Ooh, that's interesting.
So you basically would have the tiebreak over any team that you're tied with.
That's interesting. Yeah, that would have been fun. Sure, I would have liked that.
Maybe the reason they didn't want to do that is because they just want it to be its own separate thing. They don't want it to be like, oh yeah, this is like another stepping stone of the gym. They want it to be completely separate, as it is obviously in European soccer.
A problem this could have, I mean, I don't think it's clear how many pool play games there'll be. You're not going to play everybody. Like, how unbalanced are the schedules in this? Right? Like, is one team have a super easy road to make that 8-team elimination stage? Or some teams have super hard roads? Like, I'm curious how balanced that is.
Yeah, and it could also actually lead to teams that make this tournament having a harder schedule than teams that don't, because you would think by definition you're playing other really good teams in this tournament. Absolutely. Those games count in the regular season for two games, and then you take those eight best teams out, and now you're, you know, all the other teams get to play the, you know, the 22 worst teams.
Another concern that has popped in my head, so I don't know exactly what this is going to look like, but I did in the dunks, this was probably a couple months ago now, kind of a guess of what the setup could be, and at a certain point it sounds like those teams that don't make this stage of eight, they're going to end up with extra games scheduled against each other because of arena conflicts and all of that. Like, are we going to have more back-to-backs because it's going to, this whole schedule is not going to be set as far in advance, and so there's going to be more conflicts, and it is travel. Are those things going to be even worse? And I'll say this, the number one thing that's going to determine whether this works, number one, how much do the teams in the very first championship game care? Are they playing all out to win that? And are they like loving it? Are they celebrating big? Yeah. That's going to be huge.
Well, presumably you're not going to get there unless you're playing all out.
It's just regular season games. Like, somebody's got to make it. And it could go the other way. If somebody gets hurt in that extra game, in that championship game, it could ruin the whole thing forever.
Okay, let's finish up with this. Who won this negotiation?
Players. A lockout is devastating to players. Their careers are short. Their salaries are high. Players cannot afford a lockout. Owners win every lockout. For the system to continue on, that alone, players won. And then we can go all the way, call back to the very beginning of this episode where I said the number one thing is the players added to their revenue pie. I can't believe it. Giant win for the players.
Yeah, I would say so. I think I would say both parties, number one, because they actually agreed on some things that make sense for both parties, you know, such as the smoothing as well. And ultimately for the players, I think they actually, the players won on the money and were willing to kind of give up more system thing. Like, the owners actually wanted more system stuff. Usually it's the players want system stuff. The owners will like get stuff on the money as a result of that. Like, they're the ones who care about the bottom line. And it's interesting that if anything, that is kind of reversed a little bit. And I agree with you. Obviously, you know, the owners do have this TV contract coming up. You know, so there is like a little leverage for the players where maybe the owners are less willing to have a work stoppage than they might have been in, say, 2011, when the next TV contract wasn't until 2016. And then, you know, we had the new TV deal last time as well, right before the CBA. This time, the timing of the CBA ending right before the next TV deal, maybe that was a little more leverage for the players than we may have appreciated. I mean, the owners are trying to, like, they could be negotiating right now with exclusive negotiating window with ESPN and Turner. And then in the spring of 2024, as is anticipated, we talked about this with Andrew Marchand a couple of weeks ago, that it's just going to open up to everyone. And yeah, no, you probably don't want to be in the middle of a lockout when you're trying to negotiate that. So maybe that was a little bit more. And we saw the owners get off of this upper spending limit. I don't know if they were even ever fully united on that. It might have just been like bullshit negotiating as well. The players seem to have like gotten them off of that very early on.
Well, I will say I do think the second apron is far closer to a hard cap than I ever thought the players would go for. It's not called a hard cap, but I think it's going to work a lot closer to a hard cap, with the exception of 1 to 2 teams.
Yeah, but the fact that you can re-sign your own players and exceed it, that I think, and you can always sign guys to the minimum, like that's...
Well, sign guys to the minimum, I mean, that's...
And, yeah.
But even if, let's just say it works out that you don't have a player you want to re-sign and you're not quite rich enough where you're going to re-sign anybody to preserve the salary slot. If you don't re-sign a guy that year and you dip below that apron, that second apron, good luck getting back over it, right? You have to have the player there to re-sign.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that you mentioned, the unintended consequences of this, how valuable is it, say, a second round pick who's productive in the third year of his deal, about to be a restricted free agent that's making the minimum that you would then have full bird rights on? How valuable is that guy to trade for if you're a team like the Clippers, and then you can bump your salary up? And then, hey, you could always trade that guy later too.
Yeah.
As well. But as a means to like get your salary up there. But again, this is maybe three teams that like are going to be thinking about. You know, even like a team like the Bucks or, you know, the Lakers, they're not going to be thinking of like, okay, we have to get our salary as high as possible, right? Like there's a couple of teams that might think about that. And even those teams will probably only think about it if you have like a Kawhi and Paul George on the team at the same time. So I really don't think it's going to affect that many teams' behavior.
But isn't overall. Isn't that far more concerning? Because I think what nobody wants is just a couple teams have a massive advantage.
Yeah, you don't want this to be a bill of attainder, basically.
Yeah, I think. I don't know exactly what that means, but sure, that sounds right.
A bill of attainder, it's basically like a law that's just designed to like screw over one person or entity, is the way I remember it from law school 20 years ago.
I guess I'm saying the opposite. I think a lot of the unintended consequences, this could help the Lakers, or not the, excuse me, the Clippers, the Warriors, and if there's anybody else, like... It could make it so that their advantage over the rest of the teams is so strong that the gap is even wider.
Maybe that's true. I mean, that's what ended up happening with just the more stringent luxury tax penalties last time. But yeah, I going back to the original question, I agree with you. The players did better than I expected, other than this additional apron. And like that was another thing where I think the players took advantage of some things that like the owners really wanted. There are certain owners like that were kind of freaking out about certain things that honestly probably didn't really matter as much. And these owners were convinced that they did really matter. And so the players took advantage of that to get stuff that they wanted. And I don't think it really hurts the players that much in the end. So we'll see. We got many more details. We got 6 years to find out what we were wrong about. I'm sure it'll be fascinating to go back and listen to this podcast 2-3 years from now and see what we were right on, what we were wrong on, what we missed. But yeah, this is a lot of fun. Thanks for doing this. This is great, great stuff. And we'll be back tomorrow. Got so much more stuff to get to this week. We obviously the playoff race. We got to catch up on that tomorrow. We still, you guys were kind enough to submit mailbag questions. We still got to answer. We got to talk about the games.
The mailbag channel in the Discord is still open if you want to get questions. If you're listening to this shortly after it's published, last chance to get those in.
Yeah, and I'm going to be at the Nike Hoop Summit this week as well. Hollinger and I are going to do top 10 players in the NBA. My head's swimming, but this is why you listen to Dunked On, because we're going to get to all of it. And really excited to have you all as a subscriber. If you're listening on the public feed, please consider subscribing. We'll have John and I with top 10 players in the NBA, one of the best shows that we do, obviously. Oh, we're going to do awards this week, by the way. Remember those? Yeah, this could be massive.
Now, are you considering players who are going to play less than 65 games?
Well, I better do it now while I have the chance. All right, that's it for tonight. We'll talk to you all soon.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.